50 to 70% of the impact on the way in which you feel at work is due to your leader. Because most of us are working with smart people. Nobody doesn't want to do a good job. Most of us have worked in organizations that are pretty well resourced, could always use more. But the key differential is that leader.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and I am so excited to share the brilliance of our guest with you today. His name is Scott Hutchinson. He is a biosocial scientist and senior lecturer at Purdue University, where his teaching, research, and professional practice centers on leadership, team, and organizational performance through the lens of the biology of behavior. With over 30 years of experience, Dr. Hutchinson has worked with hundreds of organizations across industry, higher education, public and nonprofit sectors. His clients have included the White House, Fortune 500 companies, startups, and rural communities, helping them address challenges related to competitiveness, innovation, sustainability, and public health. He's the author of numerous academic articles and essays, and his 2019 release, Strategic Doing, 10 Skills for Agile Leadership, became an Amazon number one bestseller in 6 categories and was on multiple bestsellers lists. He's also a columnist for Forbes, where his articles are read by millions. In fact, he ranks in Forbes' top 0.1%. in readership. Dr. Hutchinson is also a sought-after speaker, delivering keynotes and workshops all across the globe. His TED Talk on the science of prospection has been viewed more than 1.3 million times. Today, he's here to talk about his newest book, Biohacking Leadership, Leveraging the Biology of Behavior to Maximize Your Impact. Scott, I've given us a lot to live up to here. This is going to be an awesome episode. I am so grateful you're with us today on the Daily Helping. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Dr. Richard. It is a pleasure to be on the Daily Helping podcast.
I love it. I'm so excited about your area of expertise. I'm so excited to dig into this book with you. But before we do that, I want to jump into the Dr. Hutchinson time machine. Let's go back in time. Talk to us about what puts you on the path you're on today, because you're helping so many people all over the world, and I kind of want to find out your superhero origin story.
It's a unique one, I think. So I had just graduated with a degree, an undergraduate degree in theater. That's a long way from where we are today. And so my track was directing. So I saw myself as being an artistic director at a community theater somewhere, a regional theater. And I happened to be directing one of my first productions. And in that cast, it was a community theater production, so everyone was an amateur. And in that cast was a guy who turned out to be a scientist at a nearby research lab. And as we would get to know one another and have chats for after rehearsals or drinks, after a performance, he said, you know what? Theater is the most collaborative of all the arts, and I think there are lessons in collaboration and leadership that could apply back to this research lab where I work. So he said, what would you think about doing some workshops? So Dr. Richard, I would love to say that, you know, that sparked my career interest, but what it sparked was my interest in perhaps a paycheck. So my next question was, does this pay? Because I was still kind of a starving artist. And he said, yeah, it pays. I said, all right, let's do it. And so that's what we did. We developed a workshop, a leadership workshop on how to lead more collaboratively across the various disciplines that this lab was bringing together to address some pretty wicked problems. And it turned out really well. It landed well. The lessons translated perfectly from theater to this work setting. And it really opened my ideas to perhaps a different sort of application to what I had been learning and theater. And so I didn't immediately set aside my dreams for theater, but more opportunities came about to be working with emerging leaders, specifically in kind of science, research, and technology-centric kinds of organizations. And I really doubled down on that. I said, I think I want to learn more about leadership, team, and organizational performance. And that's what set me on this track. And that was way back in the late 1980s.
I love that. May I ask the production you were putting on at the time, out of curiosity?
Yeah, it was a production of Amadeus. You know, it, a lot of people know as a film, but it was a stage play before that. One of the discussions that we had was the difference between stage presence and backstage presence. Now, you might have some prima donna that's great on stage, but they're toxic, you know, backstage. And I remember discussing, gosh, the perfect performer is someone who has both. You know, someone that can draw a cast together, regardless of whether they're first on the call sheet or not.
So that set the die in motion, so to speak, for you to go down this leadership rabbit hole. But part of what we're talking about today is the biology of behavior. So, you know, the biohacking, the neuroscience, those sorts of things. So when did that piece get added to the equation?
My approach to leadership has always been behavioral. So I'm a social scientist. I'm interested in behaviors within social systems. And to me, leadership was always more about how you behave than how you think. You know, you may be a great strategic thinker, but no one can see how you think. So your behavior has to signal how you think. So for a long time, we worked on kind of the behavioral aspect of leadership, the behavioral aspect of the patterns of behaviors within teams. And then at that more macro level, when you talk about culture and values in an organization, well, those are behavioral as well. So about 5 years ago, though, something was happening personally. I got a diagnosis of diabetes. It had run in the family, you know, every annual physical, the A1C would be a little bit higher, a little bit higher. And finally, I crossed that threshold. And so with the consultation of my doctor, I said, I want to get a handle on the biology of this thing. You can't heal diabetes, but I learned that you could tweak your behavior, not just what you ate, but how you moved and how you managed stress and the quality of your sleep. And with great tools like a continuous glucose monitor, which I wear, the terrific data that you get from a good smartwatch, I began to see that I could tweak my behavior and impact what was going on inside my body. So I never really considered myself a biohacker, but then I learned those terms. And, you know, there, between you and me and your listeners, there's a lot of junk science out there under the biohacking umbrella. But the fundamental notion that translating this to leadership, leadership is behavior, right? Behavior is biological. We behave in ways that we have evolved to behave. And biology can be understood. And if you can understand it, you can tweak it. You can tweak your behavior. So as I thought about, well, what would be a kind of a hook for this science? And I said, well, what about biohacking leadership? And then as I told you before the broadcast started, it's the first in a three-book series. So next will be biohacking teams, biohacking organizations. So biohacking is, you know, we're borrowing it from a different field, but saying, look, you can understand leadership, team performance and organizational performance as a set of biological patterns, and you can change the signals that change those behaviors.
I think the blood glucose analogy was genius because it's so easy to visualize and understand. You're getting real-time data, and as a result of what that data is telling you, you're making these small shifts in your behavior patterns, which in turn improve your blood glucose levels.
Yeah. And I'm happy to say that my blood glucose level is down to a pre-diabetic, well, not even pre-diabetic, non-diabetic range. And as long as I keep those behavioral patterns constant, I'm confident I'll stay in that low range for a long time. Now, there's no guarantee that your pancreas might someday say, I'm done.
Right.
But as long as I have those consistent behavioral patterns, all these other things fall into place.
And as you mentioned, the borrowing of terms, right? Biohacking got really popular around 2010-ish, I think is when I probably first heard it. What you're talking about from a behavior standpoint And certainly the analogy of the rock star on stage plus somebody who's good backstage, to me, that screams EQ, right? And you were talking about emotional intelligence probably long before that became vogue, right? You've been doing this for 30 years. And, you know, it's been in the last decade or two that people are running around, you know, EQ, EQ, you know, everything is EQ. And, you know, there's a good amount of literature that would suggest that in many respects, EQ may be actually important, more important than IQ, right?
Absolutely.
So let's kind of dive in and let me ask you this, because I know the book is the first in this trilogy of three books that you've got coming out. But, you know, the book is new and you've been doing this for decades. So why now? Why write this book now?
Yeah, you know, my history with books, including the one that came out in 2019 that you mentioned in my bio, is that the practice comes first. So some sort of insight born out of research, and then some model that's developed and then tested. And then later, after kind of demonstrating that model and some test beds and say, yeah, this seems to work, people are receiving value from this model in my classrooms or in the work that I do outside the university, now it's time for a book. And for me, in both those instances, the book was for me a way to begin pulling all these pieces together in a much more coherent way, whether it was, you know, something I've been writing about for Forbes or something I've been teaching in the classroom. Well, I can give it some coherence in a book, and it becomes a way to spread the insights more broadly. And from a marketing perspective, a book is a great thing to hand people and get them interested in these tools and these insights that can make a big difference in their lives.
Amazing. So let's jump into it. So biohacking leadership. Let's look at we're your students here, and it's biohacking leadership 101. Where do we start?
All right. So let's start with a bit of a mental exercise. Of course, your listeners will have to respond, and we'll imagine their response. But I often ask people to think about a time in a work setting where you were working under a supervisor or a manager, or maybe you're close enough to the senior leadership. But something about working in that organization or in that team, it was bringing out the best in you. You were fully engaged. You were satisfied with your work. And I asked them, how do you remember feeling during those times in your professional life? And we'll sometimes list them on the board. And, you know, people will say, you know, I felt like I was learning all the time. I felt engaged. I felt seen. I felt heard. All these wonderful things that make us not dread coming to work every day. But then I'll ask, all right, now maybe you've also had times where you did not feel that way. You were working in a situation and you were tempted to draw back, tempted to disengage. You started to dread going to work. How are you feeling then? Dread, anger, frustration. Sometimes the list gets even longer because I think that trauma can live with us for a long time. So then we look to the literature and say, why do we sometimes feel great at work? Why do we sometimes feel awful at work in different situations? And depending on which of those outcomes you're looking at, whether it's engagement or job satisfaction, 50 to 70% of the impact on the way in which you feel at work is due to your leader. Because most of us are working with smart people. Nobody doesn't want to do a good job. Most of us have worked in organizations that are pretty well resourced, could always use more, but the key differential is that leader. So then we can say, all right, well, what signals was that leader sending that prompted those emotions? And then we can kind of diagnose, oh, all right, if the leader had behaved differently in this situation, right, would you have felt different? So what we look at is this kind of cycle of behavior. A leader sends a signal. And what they say, how they say it, how they show up in a room, right? That signal is felt. First, we feel it physiologically. You know, you've all felt that knot in your stomach at work, right? But you've also felt the hairs on the back of your neck stand up because you're inspired by the work that you're doing. And so we feel it physiologically first in our nervous system and our gut. And then our brain interprets that as a feeling. Oh, I recognize this. This is good. This is bad. This is happy. This is sad. And then those emotions spill out into our behavior. And a leader who is in tune with the behaviors of others, has a high level of emotional intelligence, if you will, pays attention to the behavior and then does a self-check and say, are my behaviors cycling through and causing those behaviors? And if they are, how do I change this behavioral signals that I send? So that, in essence, is what we are teaching leaders. We're teaching them about the behavioral signals that they send have a significant impact on not just the emotion, but the performance of those that are under their leadership.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. To boil it down simply, the signals that a leader is sending are causing these emotions to cascade in the employees. I'm curious, did your research indicate how much was direct behavior, such as statements, actions, versus how much were things like nonverbal communication?
We looked at all those things, and what we boiled them down to. So a research project looked at, all right, what are the signals that lead to high levels of engagement, high levels of performance, and signals that also help others even categorize whether someone is an effective leader or not. Even in first impressions, you know, when we're evaluating a political candidate, or when we are on the other end of the hiring table and we're hiring someone to be a team manager, what are the signals that we look for to say lots of leadership potential, or I'm not so sure, or yeah, I want to cast my vote for that person. Oh, I'm not so sure. So our model identified kind of a minimally viable set of behavioral signals that we now call biomarkers, right? Just like my blood diagnostics, right? So there's 18 biomarkers. And when you start to check off many of those 18, we say that person is an effective leader or has the potential to be effective leader. When we see the absence of them or the opposites of them, we're saying that is not someone I want in a leadership position. And not only did we identify 18, but they clustered together under what we refer to as three biodynamic channels. And those biodynamic channels are warmth, competence, and gravitas. So we can now help leaders self-evaluate, get feedback evaluation, and then teach emerging leaders and even senior leaders to dial up their warmth, to dial up their competence, and to dial up their gravitas in ways that optimize those signals that they send and drive performance.
In terms of those biodynamic channels, and I love that, you know, these 18 roll up into these three more broad categories. Was there any one particular of those channels? Was warmth, you know, 38% of the equation, but gravitas was 29% of the equation? Or was it a pretty close to 33, 33, 33 in the split?
You know, the reason we settle on the term of biodynamics is because effective leaders know how to dial every one of these up to 11, but they also need to understand there are times when perhaps I need to dial one of these down. So a leader needs to understand the dynamics. And there are times when I might need to lead with warmth. In fact, most of the time, I think you lead with warmth. But there are times during crisis where you don't have time for warmth. You lead with your competence. If you're the only person who knows where the exit is and the building is on fire, whether literally or metaphorically, it is your competence. So it's your expertise that says, follow me, we're getting out of the room. So it's less about which one was most important. All three had to be present. You drop any one of those out and you don't have kind of the trifecta of what it means to be perceived of as a leader.
It makes perfect sense. As I'm sitting here listening to you, I'm also curious because you have 3 decades worth of experience, and there's no question that in the last 30 years, the workplace, particularly in the West, has undergone significant cultural changes, significant changes with respect to the different generations. We know that, you know, boomers work differently than does Gen X, than does, you know, millennials, than does Gen Z. So broadly, as we're looking at leadership, across different generations, what are some of the patterns that your research showed?
You know, I don't put as much stock into those generational differences as some people do, because I think at a fundamental level, we all need the same things to be satisfied, to feel like that we are contributing. The ways in which those signals can be sent, however, and received vary greatly. So a hastily worded email or a well-crafted email sends a signal. And that's not something that I experienced in my first job, which was pre-email. So the signals that I got from leadership, they were only in real time. They were only during FaceTime. You know, maybe there's a newsletter, but the patterns of communication was very, very differently. So I think that there are these micro moments now and different channels, if you will, of face-to-face versus synchronous versus asynchronous digital, the way we're communicating right now. I think those are the fundamental things that have changed. Those are the things that have changed. But fundamentally, we all want to connect with people who have warmth. We all want to learn from people who have competence. And my definition of gravitas is a planetary one. We have a planet that has one moon, and with gravity, we've pulled that moon into our orbit, and it exerts some gravity on us, too, that makes everything work, like our tides and all that would cascade into catastrophe if we didn't have that. So for me, gravitas is pulling people together to create shared value. So whether you are 20 years old, like my youngest son, or whether you're 60-year-old like me, I want to connect with people because they're warm. I want to learn from them because they have an area of expertise or competence that is valuable to me. And I want to align with people where we can do something of shared value. So those, I think, are universal and translate across generations.
What an excellent response, and actually gives me comfort hearing that, because there's so many people saying, oh, if you're working with this generation, you have to do this and you can only talk to them a certain way. But you're saying, no, you know, maybe there's minute differences in the messaging, but at a fundamental level, these needs are there, right? These overarching themes. I'm going to ask you one other kind of, probably not in your book, but off the wall question. If you jump around the media and see what people tend to be overly stressed about right now, it's the impact on artificial intelligence in the workplace. Have you seen any emerging trends or concerns or benefits of using AI in developing leadership?
I have. In fact, that formula that I just mentioned of sending signals of warmth, competence, and gravitas, I have built a kind of my own AI model to say, all right, I need to write an email to this student or this person who is really stressed out. You know, here's the situation. Help me lean into warmth first, then competence, then gravitas, and even structuring this email. And I have found that it can help me brainstorm and structure a message that lands and sends the right signals. Now, could I get there on my own? Yeah, but I can train an AI model, for instance, to help me do that. So that's one way in which I'm using AI as a tool to kind of augment my own work. But of course, AI for others is calling significant stress into play. You know, one of my own sons is studying a technology-related field, and just in the 4 years he's been in school, he's now wondering, is AI going to make my skill set irrelevant? That was not even a thought when he was 18 years old in his freshman classes. So there is stress as well. And how leaders help those they lead to manage that stress and to look for the opportunities that these new tools can provide, I think is an important part of leadership today. It's a big question mark for all of us. And it requires, I think, conversation that's deep and focused and thinking about what's next with these incredible tools.
I've created emails with AI, and I'll tell it to summarize X and, you know, write this with a professional tone. Never has it dawned on me, and I'm sure people listening to this right now, that I could use that to write the tone in a certain way that would convey emotional triggers that we want the recipient to receive. That's really interesting. Really interesting, Scott. So let's jump back to the book a little bit. We've now kind of set the stage. We've got these 18 biomarkers, which roll up into these three critically important categories. My question is, so if somebody reads this book and they, you know, have been able to self-assess or assess others in terms of where they fall in these categories, the question is, now what do we do, right? So if they're lacking in warmth or gravitas, or, you know, more specifically, one of the subcomponents of those, how do we remedy that?
So what we do is we ask people, first of all, you know, we've defined it for them. Right, well, what is warmth? Well, warmth is when you see these kind of six biomarkers in place. That means someone listens with intent. They validate others. They're other-oriented in their conversation. You know, those are just three. Well, what does that look like? Well, we provide some examples, right? For each of those biomarkers, if you will, we provide kind of a mini use case. But then we also go to real-life leaders. Almost always real life leaders. Let me qualify that. Sometimes we're looking at leaders from history, some contemporary leaders, but every once in a while I've thrown in a fictional leader, a favorite leader from a novel or even a piece of fiction that I admire. Atticus Finch from To Kill a Mockingbird is one that I threw in there. So we can see what that looks like in others, and then we can try on what we learn from them ourselves. But then near the end of the book, we have two really important chapters. One is on the neuroscience of storytelling, and the other is the neuroscience of conversation. And so we take those models of warmth, competence, and gravitas and apply them on how you might tell a quick story to illustrate something that is of value to you, to your team, whether it's your organizational values or sharing a client experience. And then we do the same thing with conversation. And I love the phrase, conversation is the smallest unit of change. And conversations, as we all know, can be life-changing. They all have to be, right? But they send signals. So what we do when we dig deeper into those warmth, competence, and gravitas, we look at neurochemicals like oxytocin, cortisol, norepinephrine, right? And dopamine, and say, all right, when someone is coming in stressed, probably their cortisol is high. They can't think clearly. You get locked up in your head. Right. So you need to dial up warmth, because when you boost oxytocin, the bonding hormone, you reduce cortisol. So that's what we mean by, all right, dial up those signals of warmth. And then once you get cortisol down, well, then you can move into kind of competence within a conversation. You can share your competence. You can pull out the competence of others. Well, you know, what do you know about this situation? You know, here's what my experience has taught me. And then gravitas, that's the last part of the conversation. We say, here's how we can move forward together. What are two or three shared action items you and I can take together to make the best of this situation? So helping leaders understand, you know, not only those channels and not only the signals, but what is likely going on inside the person from a neurochemical perspective. How do we recognize high cortisol? And then how do we recognize, all right, their shoulders are dropping. I think they're going to be more receptive to what comes next because I'm really leaning into my signals of warmth. So that's what we mean by biodynamics. And those are some of the ways you can put these insights to work, whether you are telling a story, right, for to teach or to inspire, or you're having a really vital conversation.
I love this. You know, people obviously aren't sitting there when they're having those conversations, whether it's with their spouse or whether it's, you know, with their teammates, thinking about, well, let me look at the nonverbal cues. Are those things telling me that, you know, this person might have elevated cortisol if they, you know, walked into the building in a state of fear and anxiety ridden? They're in that amygdalic loop where they're not really probably very rational right now. And so I like that you've got these chapters that kind of nuance these things and walk people through being able to identify those signs. Because it's like, I've told many parents this right from a stage, that you cannot have a rational conversation with somebody who's yelling and screaming at you. And you know, in kind, if your kid is just looking at you with these big, big eyes, you aren't going to be as effective if you're ranting and raving, right? So I love that, you know, this is pulling the biology, this is pulling the behavior, this is pulling science, this is like my happy place, Scott. So I love that you're putting all of this together. And so I'm excited about this book. I can't wait till the sequel and the next one come out. And, you know, I hope everybody picks this up. Scott, I do want to ask you as we move to close here, as you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guests just this one question. What is your biggest helping, that one most important takeaway you'd like somebody to walk away with after hearing our conversation today?
I think it's this, that when you find yourself in a leadership role, think of it as a learning opportunity. If you've never been a leader before, or if you've never led this team before, or you've never led at this level before, you don't know how to do it. You're going to have to experiment. Just like, you know, I remember my oldest son, the first time he had a girlfriend, like, I don't know how to be a boyfriend. Right? So we don't know how to be a boyfriend. We don't know how to be a husband or a wife. We figure it out, hopefully, through trial and error. We try things. We try sending behavioral signals. And if it's not landing well, if we're aware enough, we adjust those signals. It's the same thing with leadership. We learn to lead through experimentation. We try things. We see what other leaders have done. We try those on for size. Might work for us, might not. But every interaction with those you lead, whether you are an entrepreneur pitching to funders, or whether you already have a small team or a big organization, every interaction is an opportunity to experiment. And if the experiment lands, well, then that's evidence that, oh, I should maybe keep this as part of my repertoire. When it doesn't, gosh, I yelled at them and they didn't listen. So I yelled louder and they still didn't listen. Well, maybe it's time to adjust those signals, as you suggested with the parents. So bottom line, you learn to be a leader through experimentation and refinement.
Well said. The book is Biohacking Leadership, Leveraging the Biology of Behavior to Maximize Your Impact. It's available everywhere books are sold. But if people want to find out more about you and the work that you're doing, where can they find that online?
Yeah, they can go to biohackingleadership.com, or they can go to scotthutchison.com, or they can find me on LinkedIn.
Perfect. And for those of you at the gym, we got you covered. Everything Scott Hutchison will be linked in the show notes at drrichardschuster.com. Well, Scott, I loved our conversation. So excited about this book. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And to each and every one of you who took time out of your day, thank you as well. If you liked it, if you're excited, if you're going to go and try and figure out which biomarkers you're strong in, go give us a follow and a 5-star review on your podcast app of choice, because this is what helps other people find this show. But most importantly, go out there today and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post it in your feeds using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.